Good people, welcome to this week's episode of the Milk the Cow podcast. This week featuring Tom Fowler. What to say about Tom? Firstly, I consider Tom to be an absolute hero. Seriously, there's not many people that I consider to be heroes. When I was younger, it was Alan Shearer, but I realised that he could score goals, but he's not that great a lad. Whereas Tom, I don't know if he can score goals or not, but what a great lad. And I tell you, like, without him being at the Spy Cops Tribunal, which you'll find out about in the podcast, of course, I just don't know where we would be. He's getting the information out there, but he's also hilarious. So do follow the links in the description to his Twitter feed and also for general Spy Cops information as well. I believe spycops.info.com. Also, spycops.info have a podcast. You'll find it everywhere you find podcasts, but also you'll find the link in the description of this podcast. I've listened to all of them, and what a great historical record they are providing, and what a great bunch of people, many of whom have been through so much. And this podcast that we're doing today, but definitely the series they've put together, it just gives voice to that and also gets those stories out in a format that it deserves in the long format, which is one of the brilliant things about podcasts, I feel. Also, if you want to support what we are doing, which is initially a live stream every week on a Tuesday at 7 p.m. We're branding it Cow Daily, and the reason being is it's a different thing from this podcast, the Milk the Cow podcast, and it's so we can keep abreast of the matters of the day and we can hold people accountable. And also, we've joined the Independent Media Association. Thanks to them for all of the help and advice they've given us. We're applying to be regulated by IMPRESS, which is the independent media regulator, regulated to a higher standard than the mainstream media, which is an important thing that we welcome. Also, we want everybody involved with Milk the Cow to be members of the National Union of Journalists. Also, by becoming a patron, you help us to pay people good money, decent wages at union rates. Really important, and it means we can retain staff, and with your help, that's a great thing because it ensures continuity within the organisation and just helps us grow quicker and faster. So go to patreon.com/cowdaily. What you get out of it is obviously instant access to Milk the Cow's private chat forum where you can talk freely and openly, which is an important thing these days. Access to Milk the Cow's monthly mental health drop-in. Really important in these times, I feel, when we're also atomized and split from each other. It's a way that we can find support. And for many of us, we can't actually leave the house. Or, you know, it's just a private way that works for people, and it's something we want to provide. Long-time supporters of Milk the Cow will know. When we were running events before the pandemic, a percentage of the ticket sales would go to funding the EMDR PTSD therapy fund for obviously people with PTSD. Some great stories that have come out of that, and a lot of help because of your help. And that's something we'd like to implement again as well. Not just through events, because at the moment that's not possible, but obviously a percentage of what we're doing here. Something for us to obviously work towards together as a community. So this episode featuring Tom Fowler talking to us about Spy Cops. Big up, Tom, and big up yourselves. Hello, once again. Welcome to the Milk the Cow podcast. As ever, we have Alice Wolf with us, but we're blessed to have Tom Fowler here to tell us about Spy Cops. Hello, Tom. How are you doing?
Hey, man. How you doing? You all right?
I'm good, man. Hello, Alice.
Hello.
Tom, just straight off the bat, if you could just let me know, what are Spy Cops?
Okay, so when we use the term Spy Cops, we're talking about the undercover political police that have been used in the UK, specifically two units, the Special Demonstration Squad and the National Public Order Intelligence Unit. Mm-hmm. The SDS, the Special Demonstration Squad, was set up in 1968 following the way the police lost control of the anti-Vietnam War demonstration in Grosvenor Square in May of that year. Over the next 50 years, they were deployed into like pretty much every progressive left-wing group, organization movement in the UK. It started off with the anti-Vietnam War movement. It quickly spread to things like the anti-apartheid movement and anti-fascism across the left, socialist, anarchist, communist groups. These officers used a variety of methods to infiltrate groups and would... Well, I mean, so the most famous thing that they did was ended up sort of deceiving women into long-term intimate relationships. In some cases, they fathered children with their targets before disappearing after a period of 4 to 5 years.
Yeah. Wow. So, I mean, how long generally, like, do you know how far back this goes? Like, what's the very first that you're aware of case of this occurring?
So, I mean, like, so though, like, spying... the British state spying on like progressive movements goes back much further. In this, particularly with these units, the what we refer to as spy cops, as opposed to like MI5 or anything more like complex than that. It's 1968. The unit is set up pretty much in, like immediately after that demonstration in the May of that year. Conrad Dixon, who sets up the unit, says. Because basically they lost completely control that day. I mean, if you've ever heard of the Battle of Grosvenor Square.
Yes.
So essentially, like, kind of the protesters, like, kind of nearly got into the U.S. embassy. The plan was to storm the embassy, ring Hanoi and say, you know, that we have occupied in solidarity with anti-imperialist movements worldwide. We have occupied the U.S. embassy. And it didn't get that far, obviously, but it got bloody close, supposedly. Yeah. So, yeah, the next day, Conrad Dixon, in a meeting with the Home Secretary and various senior members of the Metropolitan Police, says, give me, like, 10 good men, £500,000 a year, and this will never happen again.
Right.
Specifically, they were looking at the second Vietnam Solidarity Campaign national demonstration in the October of that year. And the undercover officers were first deployed to make sure that that event was not a repeat of the first. So 10 officers were deployed into groups all around London, local branches of the Vietnam Solidarity Campaign. Interestingly, they were all there at the meeting that decided should the demo go back to Grosvenor Square or should they instead do a show of strength in Hyde Park? It's a very narrow vote. The vote to go to Hyde Park instead wins. It's not quite enough for the 10 undercover cops who are present to swing it, but it's not far off. Mm-hmm. Certainly by this point, they're already they're deep into these groups. And I should point out, so these undercover officers... The first undercover officers, they're already special branch cops, and like previously they'd worked in what they call like plain clothes roles.
Sure. Just so, for people who don't know, what is special branch? Because conscious that sometimes there's like an assumed sort of knowledge for people, and sometimes people know those sort of like those basic things. So.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So special branch is a part of the police. It's part of the it's a non-uniformed section of the police. They have various different roles, but one of them is to monitor public disorder and subversion.
Yeah.
And so like this unit, firstly the special demonstration squad, later on the NPORU, they act as the like foot soldiers for like the security services. Sure. They're not the security services themselves. They're not MI5. They're not MI6. They are the normal plod, like if you like, they're normal cops. But there's a two way use of information between them and the security services for the monitoring of what later became known as domestic extremists.
Right. And who defines what a domestic extremist is?
Right. Yeah. What's been really interesting is like particularly so there's a public inquiry currently underway into undercover police units. So we at the moment we're only up to the early 80s. We've looked at a lot of the 1970s, and during that time period, any kind of basic student of history will know that the National Front and the far right in the UK was on the rise in a significant manner in the 1980s. There was a bunch of racist murders, racial attacks. The National Front themselves were like kind of on the rise in a big way. During that time, there was zero undercover police put into those movements. At the same time, the anti-fascist movement, very telling, man. We heard like numerous undercover officers line up giving evidence at the inquiry, saying the National Front weren't a problem at the time.
Is that because the police officers just joined the National Front because they liked it and they didn't have to go undercover?
Well, yeah, quite. There's a suggestion in there, you know? I mean, it's something we see more recently, like, you know, kind of look at Greece with the rise of Golden Dawn, you know, that, that there was significant police support for fascist groups, you know.
Of course. I mean, there's certain countries, I think it's Spain, they've got the fasci symbol, the axe with the tied up rods underneath on the side of the police vehicles still. I think it goes back to Franco and they've just never got rid of it, which I just think, well, how on earth could that still be a thing, you know?
But yeah, man.
It's not for me to speak on what the Guardia Civil are doing, I suppose, but like it's a bit of a bad one. So does this special demonstration squad still exist, Tom? Is it still around?
So they were disbanded in 2008. But essentially their role had been replaced by then by the National Public Order Intelligence Unit. There was a short period of time they were both running at the same time. The SDS was a Met police unit. Operating in the capital. The National Public Order Intelligence Unit was set up under ACPO, the Association of Chief Police Officers, and was run across the UK. And it appears it basically copied the SDS structure, but just made it national. And then after a few years, they sort of sunsetted the SDS, and the NPORU went national and bid with both the rest of the country and the capital. Obviously, then in 2000, late 2010, early 2011, the undercover cops started getting exposed. And supposedly, so the NPORU was wound up and became part of Counterterrorism Command.
So I'm going to ask you, how did they start getting exposed? What was the first seed of that? Because Alice and myself have been involved in like sort of protest activist movements for, well, many years as well. And we've had concerns or doubts about people in those movements also. It's definitely since spy cops started to be not a conspiracy theory. You know, and there's obviously the paranoia aspect that which I guess these spy cops play on also. So how on earth did you get the evidence to really sort of get this to where it is today?
So it all starts sort of like kind of like untangling, I guess, with Peter Francis, whose cover name was Peter Black when he was deployed into Youth Against Racism in Europe in the 1990s. In 2009, 2010, I can't remember exactly the date, he did an interview with The Guardian where he essentially went whistleblower about the unit. Many activists, including myself, read that and were really felt that it sounded like somebody in our lives who had not long disappeared, who was Marco Jacobs, who was infiltrated the group I was part of, South Wales Anarchists, from in the late 2009 sort of period. His description of like how they were deployed and how they were withdrawn really sort of like lined up with our experience. But then Mark Kennedy, who was using the cover name Mark Stone, was discovered, his partner at the time, the woman he was deceiving into a long-term relationship while he was deployed, found his passport, which had a different name on it. She confronted him about it. He came out with a bullshit story about what that was, but after being confronted a couple of times, he actually said, yes, he was an undercover police officer. That then went, so the Guardian ran a story about it. We approached the Guardian about Rob Evans and Paul Lewis from the Guardian, who were covering the story, said that we had another person we thought was, he disappeared now, but we thought he was undercover officer as well. And there were some people in Leeds did the same thing. Those Guardian journalists wrote up the story, went to the police and said, look, we've got an officer B, we've got an officer C. We're going to run their photographs and these articles the next day. And the police said, don't do that. Run it without the photograph and give us 3 days and we'll withdraw these from their current deployments, essentially confirming that they were indeed undercover officers. So that was the beginnings of it, really.
Right.
Yeah.
I
remember when the Mark Kennedy story broke and the Met made a really unusual statement about that. Well, what seemed unusual at the time about, you know, how this was wrong and, you know, talked about misogyny and remember thinking, wow, that's not something the police do. Maybe they're being accountable for once. However, I think what we've seen from there is it's almost been kind of framed as a bad apple scenario.
Yeah, so I mean, the initial response was very much this was a rogue officer. Then it was like it was a rogue unit, you know, before like it was, it turns out actually their reports were being seen by the Home Secretary on a regular basis. There's nothing rogue whatsoever about these units. I mean, that statement you mentioned, the one which mentions misogyny and so forth, that was a result of some legal action that was brought by a number of women. So initially, in like early 2013, 10 women and one man, I was the one man, brought legal action against the Met Police for the deployment of undercover officers. This spanned a whole bunch of different relationships. There was 8 women in one case, 2 women and one man in the other case. After a number of years going through the, like, attempting to go through the legal system for a civil claim, I think 4 of the 8 women initially, it were the settled out of court with that statement as part of the apology. Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly strange to hear the Met Police talking about misogyny. But I mean, that was the terms of the agreement that they'd met to stop them having to go through court and reveal more things. Interestingly, one of those women recently, after, God, like 10 years, managed to get to the Investigative Powers Tribunal, which is the secret internal court in the Home Office for coverage of Ripper cases. That's a regulatory Investigative Powers Act cases. And she finally actually won of it, like, because when you're bringing civil claims against the police, it's really like you don't get your day in court, essentially. Unless they're absolutely sure you're going to lose, they'll never see you in court. Because the way the insurance system works, if they make you an offer of a certain amount, you kind of have to take it. Otherwise, you're opening yourself up for huge, huge financial penalties. So it was only one of us was able to, because of, you know, complex legal reasons, only one of us was ever able to, like, kind of have a day in court about it. And that was at this very secretive court, which has a lot of closed hearings. Interestingly, I mean, she got quite a lot of disclosure about numerous undercover officers, probably more disclosure than we've got out of the public inquiry so far, to be honest.
Okay. Yeah.
Cool. So, Alice, did you have another one there?
I mean, I have been following the inquiry and the, you know, the story for a lot of years, and I'm always banging on to people about it and what happened. And, you know, particularly when you talk to them about the relationships that they had with women, people are understand that, you know, obviously really, really shocked. Even more so when you bring in children to it. There is a slight element, however, I find with people who haven't been involved in the activist movement of, oh yeah, that's really awful, but why, I've never been involved in activism, so nothing like that could ever affect me. Is that true, or should the general public be worried?
I would say not. You know, I mean, it's not the case at all. A number of the women who were deceived into long-term intimate relationships weren't involved in activism themselves, but they were, like, close enough to people who were, that they were a suitable, like, cover partner. There's a theory which we haven't proved yet from the evidence, but it would appear that from what we can glean from, like, the Tradecraft manual, that these officers targeting women into long-term intimate relationships was part of the tactics, that was a huge part of their legend building. And that because they did in such similar ways, you know, a lot of the stories were very similar. A lot of the love letters are the same words, you know, that kind of thing. Just because they were infiltrating political groups, it wasn't necessarily members of those groups who they had those relationships with. It was, like, you know, people who socialized with them, you know, people who were, like, kind of close enough to give them sort of, like, cover for their identity.
Tom, could you explain something to us? Like, obviously, it's about sexual consent, and I think some people, like, hearing this might not, like, understand why a lot of what went on is basically, well, it's not basically, it is rape.
Right.
Could you explain, like, for somebody who's maybe unsure of this, like, what went on firstly, and also why it is rape?
So, I mean, essentially, like, you've got the women who are having these relationships with these undercover officers have no knowledge whatsoever of who these men really are. Sure. They've been presented with an identity which, so, like, most of these officers, particularly in the early days, would take their identity from that of a dead child. They'd go to Somerset House, find somebody who died very young, who's of a similar birth date as them, though often they claim to be a lot younger than they actually were. something like, you know, Andy Coles, who was known as Andy Davey, was deployed in the early 90s. Yeah, man, yeah. Like, still a Peterborough councillor. I mean, he was 34 when he was deployed. He claimed to be in his early 20s. And he started a sexual relationship with a 19-year-old. It was her first boyfriend, and deceived her into a sexual relationship over a number of years. He was married with children at the time, as they all were. But it's that thing of like, if she'd have known who he really was, there's no way that she would have ever had any intimate relationship with him whatsoever. And not only did he didn't just pick her at random. This was somebody who he would have some degree of knowledge of their life before he's deployed. He's got the support of all of his handler and all the, you know, the police national computer and all that kind of infrastructure to find out like kind of medical records or whatever else, to lay himself up as like the perfect boyfriend for this woman. Whilst at the same time reporting on her and her friends and her comrades about the political activity she was involved with. Sex by deception is it's an offence under British law. It's very rarely, like most rape law in this country, it doesn't get much tested in court. There's not a huge amount is prosecuted. But given what's happened in case law in the past, there is a lot to suggest that was there ever an opportunity to test this in front of a court? It's sex by deception. It is rape.
I agree.
And even if you look at the Sexual Offences Act and the definition of consent, it does quite specifically say under there that you can't consent to sex with somebody whose identity you've been deceived. Well, if that is not a spy cop, then I don't know what is, really. Andy Coles, is he the one? For all of that, the police have said, you know, oh, it's, you know, a rogue person or a rogue unit. Did he actually write a booklet on basically how to deceive, or was that somebody else?
No, he was one of the authors of the Strafecraft Manual. We're not sure who the original author was. We know that Bob Lambert was one of them, and we know that Andy Coles was one of them years later. I mean, it's a strange sort of booklet. It includes a lot of like kind of cuttings from the radical press about undercover policing, which they think is like kind of a bit close to the mark. And it includes a lot of sections, some of which are very, given what we know of Andy Cole's sort of sense of humor, I guess, it's blatantly written by him. A lot of the sections are blacked out, but those which are legible give you a very kind of, there's a lot of tips and tricks, you know. It gives us a view into their, like they've got an internal slang. So they're the Hairies, right? And people that they infiltrated were the Wearies. You know, it's like a weary to hang out with these like political geeks, you know. There's a lot of dehumanization of their targets, talking about like kind of squatters eating moldy food and, you know, all sorts of strange kind of ways in which to like kind of make out the people they're infiltrating don't really deserve the respect as full human beings that everybody else would get, you know.
I've got to be honest, my piss is entirely boiled and we're 20 minutes in. And I mean, we did an audio podcast on this a few years ago as well, and researching it was where I first started getting my head around this. So I'm honored that you're here, mate, because like, obviously we want to like push this forward. Now we're doing a new series of the podcast, you know? So thank you very much for your time and educating us on what the hell's going on and what's up today. Tom, did you see that there's a Yorkshire Ripper documentary on Netflix? Have you seen that?
No, man, I'm not much of a TV kid, to be honest.
Yeah, me neither, but I'll watch the odd thing here and then. I was like told to watch it, basically because it talks a lot about the institutional sexism within the West Yorkshire Police and beyond at the time, and how more women were murdered as a result of the institutional sexism. Simply because a lot of women were just like, as you said, dehumanized, like saying they were prostitutes when they weren't. And what you were saying there about the Hairies and the Wearies just got us thinking about how like that internal like toxic culture within the law enforcement people tends to this makes me wonder, like, how can you dehumanize somebody like that for one, but also for two, how can you then go and carry out these heinous acts? And it's like, it's rape, but it's also coercion. It's also like gaslighting. It's also like just dark as fuck, basically.
So, yeah, dark as fuck, man. Dark as fuck is the phrase.
Yeah, it is. It is like I still, no matter how much we look into this, eh, Alice, I still cannot get my head around somebody being that dark to somebody else. Mm. You know, there's levels to it, and that's a new level. And the fact, like, every time I see a picture of this Andy Coles, like, I just can't, like, for one, he's a Tory councillor, which is just, you know, no more needs to be said. But for two, it just seeing him just boils my piss. Mm. I just, like, why is he still walking free? And then it brings into question for me, like from the top down in the UK, it's just corrupt as hell.
Yeah,
you know. Yep. So, which brings us to the question: do you think anybody will receive any kind of like just punishment for what they've done?
Not really. No, I don't. I mean, I don't feel like the inquiry, like public inquiries, are there for the state to learn lessons. So you can't perjure yourself in the inquiry proceedings. So if you admit to like some sort of crime whilst being questioned, that can't be used in court against you. In a funny kind of way, the inquiry means it's almost less likely, because it wasn't very likely in the first place for people to get charged with anything. But certainly it doesn't open anybody up for any sort of prosecution. It's incredibly unlikely there's any sort of justice really takes place. I mean, I think like there's been a number of people who've received civic settlements from the police because their lives have been turned upside down. A number of police officers have like kind of lost out on promotion because of their involvement. That's about as bad as it gets. I mean, I think like, I always think of, Alan Murray, who was the officer who is pretty clear was the one who beat Blair Peach to death in 1979.
Really?
I mean, he's still, you know, alive and well and working as an academic. He's always really bitter that he never got further in the police because his career was held up by the fact that, you know, this was held over him. Justice doesn't really exist in this country, right? And like, it certainly doesn't exist for like to hold police to account of all people. You know, it just doesn't work like that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Sorry, Alice, you're going to come in there.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think me and Mike have talked lots about spy cops, and as he said before, we've been involved in movements ourselves a lot. There's been a couple of people, somebody who I knew in particular, who I'm not going to say was a spy cop because I don't know, but maybe does have the hallmarks. Mm. I think what I found, and this is somebody who I only knew for a very short space of time, and for the participants, actually, it was years. A lot, you know, there's somebody who was in their lives. What kind of support is there for somebody like that? Because what I found is as soon as you start talking about this to somebody, you often sound crazy.
Yeah, man.
And you just think that, you know, you're hearing what you're saying back in your head, and you just think this sounds really, really weird. Is there any kind of support, or is there any way of finding out if somebody who you were in, you know, who you knew was a spy cop?
So there's a group called the Undercover Research Group, of which I'm sort of vaguely involved with. We publish a booklet called Was My Friend a Spy Cop? You can download it for free on the website undercoverresearch.net. It includes like this 10 points of like questioning about like kind of the way in which that person's behaved as like kind of a sign. We invite people to like kind of to use those 10 points to like kind of see if those things line up, and if they do, to get in touch with the Undercover Research Group. It's an incredibly difficult thing to like to deal with like kind of post 2011, because we're fairly clear that like the tactics will have changed, but up until then we can really like see there's certain tactics, there's a certain sort of behaviors that that really line up with how these officers were instructed to deploy themselves. So if anybody's got any concerns about that, I would really recommend them going and checking out that guide, and get in touch with the URG if they still feel that this person was probably a spy cop. I mean, I would say is also like one of the things we've really found out from through the inquiry is that the sheer number of informers and bugging that was taking place, even in the 1970s, one of the undercover officers, Barry Tompkins, was having a relationship while he was deployed. His senior officers became aware of this because an MI5 bug picked up a conversation that was taking place between some other activists about Barry's girlfriend. there was so much other kind of monitoring taking place that it was like inevitable almost that like kind of that even like the undercover cops couldn't keep anything secret from their superior officers. Similarly, when it comes to the network of informers, so we recently had the CHIS bill being passed, the Covert Human Intelligence Sources bill. As far as the police are concerned, it's not like informers, spy cops, they're all CHIS. They're all Covert Human Intelligence Sources. And like now with this new legislation, they've got like plenty of bloody, you know, plenty of leeway to do all sorts of behavior without having to worry about the legal consequences. And the numbers of like informers in political movements have always been significant. With the discovery of like these individuals who were like completely false personas, it's likely that the informer network has been like expanded significantly. I mean, certainly we know that policing in general relies in this country hugely on an informer network, an informal informer network.
Bloody hell, man. This is boggling my mind. Normally I'm a lot more talkative than this, but I'm absolutely in everything what you say. I mean, more people should get to know about this. And like here's something that's like got us thinking there, right? Like somebody who maybe isn't as sympathetic as Alice and I may go, well, if they've got nothing to hide, then like, well, you know, that shit.
Yeah, sure.
So what would you say to people like that? Like, for example, did anybody actually break the law who was being spied upon, or were they simply activists?
Define breaking the law. Like, I mean, in the course of being an activist, you will find yourself, you know, committing aggravated trespass. You will find yourself being charged with minor acts of criminal damage. You will find yourself being charged with assault of a police officer if you resist being arrested. There are plenty of laws that are supposedly broken, the vast majority of which don't end up holding up in court. Certainly we are not talking about terrorism. We are not talking about serious criminality. Those are other areas which have got other units that are dealing with them. This was the special demonstration squad. It was about people taking to the streets, mobilizing on the streets, like with a banner outside somewhere. That was what they were. That was the target. There's no like kind of there's one undercover officer was approached by a Soviet agent to like kind of because he was like in he was inside Trotsky's left group and was like approached to become an asset to the Soviets. It would appear that his superior officer shit a brick about this, and like he withdrew from any of that kind of situation. That was like far too serious. That was like MI5 work, and not something they wanted to get involved in. They were busy like infiltrating, you know, tiny left wing Marxist sects, and you know, disrupting paper sales, and all sorts of like really, you know, mundane kind of activity. I mean, when it comes to that thing when people are like, kind of, well, if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing. I mean, like, I'll be honest, I'm a bit dismissive, to be honest, of people like that. I'm probably not the best person to like kind of go, oh, you know, this is a chilling effect on our civil liberties, because I am an anarchist. My political act, I've always been against the cops anyway. I'm an abolitionist. And I'm like, just, yeah, fuck the police, man. I don't even get in those arguments. I just don't. I mean, other people should and do, but like, that ain't me. So
I'll say what you mean. And yeah, fuck the police. Like, big up NWA.
Yeah, man. Yeah, for real.
Yeah, man. Every time.
Tom, tell us a bit about the inquiry and how that is going, because I've been following a bit of that, and I find it, even for somebody who follows it, I find it so confusing. I've been listening to some of the spy cops saying things like, well, oh no, we didn't infiltrate those nasty anarchists because they're horrible and violent. We were with the nice people, but that doesn't make sense, because if they were there to try and, you know, infiltrate dangerous people, why would they be hanging out with the people who weren't breaking the law? So what's you've been obviously there right from the very start following this. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, sure. So I mean, like, it still kind of surprises me that the inquiry got called in the first place. Like, Theresa May called it in like 2015. I mean, it should have finished by now, but I mean, it only started last November, because the cops just like pulled their feet on like kind of every aspect of disclosure, every aspect of every like everything they were asked to provide. They like kind of they would ask for anonymity. They were asking for like they put in a number of judicial reviews to try and hold up the process. So I mean, but yeah, as a process, I mean, it's designed to be alienating and confusing and like not for the likes of us, right? I mean, like, it's just, I mean, the whole setup is still like kind of such a weird thing, man. It's such a weird thing, and obviously COVID's made it even more weird and confusing and difficult to follow.
Yeah, I think one of the Twitter things I was trying to follow when the inquiry was on, when they were sending it all via text and people were trying to type it out, and I was like on my lunch break trying to read it all, and all of this text was coming from, and it was, honestly, my absolute solidarity to the people who were doing that to make sure that this information got out there in the first place, because that was a lot of work trying to.
Yeah, I mean, ridiculous amount of work. I mean, like, so there was a group of us who, like, kind of have been trying to follow the inquiry and get as much information out as possible. We're live tweeting during the hearings.
We love your tweet, by the way. I just thought I'd cut in there. Absolute hero, mate.
Cheers. Cheers.
Also funny as fuck. So there was what was that one, Alice? That was
I do love Mitching's response to your tweet. telling you to wait 10 minutes for more, and you were typing it out like he told you to wait 10 minutes. I'm putting it on Twitter. I did have a good laugh.
Everybody who's on this now, you can see Tom's Twitter handle there. Go and follow it. It's funny as hell when he's live tweeting. It's brilliant. Anyway, yeah, carry on. Sorry.
Comedy is essential, comrades. Comedy is essential.
Yes, mate. We fully agree. Bit of levity.
You've got, because otherwise it's just, like you say, it's so fucking dark. I mean, it is so bloody dark. You know what I mean? You end up with this sort of gallows humor about it to a certain extent, you know. And I think so many of us who are affected, who like work on this topic, have like a really dark humor about the whole bloody thing, because it's the only way he's going to cope with it, really. Yeah. But yeah, we live tweet like kind of as things are happening, and then at the end, in the breaks, we do like a little live video on Facebook, in the Facebook group we've got, it was only the first time we did it recently, and hopefully we'll do more of that in the future as like just kind of another sort of layer of kind of trying to get stuff out. But then each evening we do write-ups of reports. I mean that bit I don't do, because I'm like, I'm fucking working all day, I can't do the write-up in the evening as well, but a bunch of people do that, and they stay up to like 2-3 in the morning to get that report, the daily reports out each day. You can find them at the campaign opposing police surveillance.com, and they're just daily reports of each day. I mean, sometimes it's like there's 2 entries per day, and you're talking like hundreds of thousands of words, and they are the most complete document really of the inquiry, more so than the inquiry's own website. Include every bit of detail that we get picked up through the day. Obviously, one of the big problems with like kind of understanding the significance of new information is like you've got to overlay that new information you found over like what we know was happening at the time. Hopefully that'll get easier to do as we get closer to like current events. But with the 1970s, a lot of it was like, well, this doesn't make sense. Why were they doing this? Then you kind of overlay it with like, oh, what we actually already know from that time period, what was happening. And it suddenly the significance kind of swims into focus. But yeah, like some of the evidence they're given is laughable, man. I mean, like, obviously there's lots of what I don't remember, I can't recall, but you know, I mean, like, plenty of the officers have like really told on themselves. Like that one about like kind of, oh no, we didn't hang out with the anarchists, they were far too dangerous, I made sure I was with the nice people. I mean, like, you just, what the fuck, man?
Yeah,
you're saying the quiet part out loud, like, you're not meant to do that, you know. But like, it's, yeah, he's like complete, like the I mean, it's really telling that even though it was with like a particularly good memory. So one of them, Graham Coates, was quite open about like the misogynist culture in the safe house, which he said would have been shockingly misogynist even then at the time within the police, which he said already had a misogynist culture anyway, but that the Special Demonstration Squad was particularly misogynistic. But even he, when it was put to him, you know, questions about spying upon Celia Stubbs and the family, the friends of Blair Peach, no, we never discussed it. Never came up, never mentioned. And I mean, we see this time and again, anybody, any sort of death in custody, any death at the hands of the police, nobody remembers nothing. Nobody remembers nothing at all. If you want to see real solidarity, don't look on a picket line, look at the cops, man. Ask a cop about a former colleague and you'll see what solidarity really looks like, you know?
Yeah.
Bloody hell. There was one thing that I wanted, hopefully you could clarify, like firstly, what is blacklisting and sort of what impact has that had on people's lives?
So, yeah, so blacklisting is, I mean, it's one of these things, like we were saying before about conspiracy theories. I mean, like, blacklisting was considered, you know, the National Employers Blacklist was considered like this piece of conspiracy theory that somehow, you know, people were making up, but to excuse the fact that they couldn't get any work when there was, you know, probably not getting work for any other perfectly good reasons. But essentially, yeah, it was a, I'm not an expert on it, but there's a group called Consulting Association sets up this blacklist, which they charge a fee to various employers to check people who have been employed. to see if they've got any background in activity that would make them like a, not an ideal employee. So, for example, if they were like active in a trade union on health and safety, then they would be a problematic employee on a building site. So they would like not get through the tendering process to get the job. Huge numbers of people were on these lists, and it became clear from what we've learnt from the investigations into that, that a lot of the information that ended up on those files was coming from undercover police officers. That certain senior members of the Special Demonstration Squad went on to work privately for the Economic League, the Consulting Association, to do this kind of work. And to run these, run the blacklist. Certainly, numerous activists who had been involved in political activism of a certain type, and had, so, for example, Richard Cheeseman, who was spied upon by a guy called Rick Gibson. Rick Gibson was outed whilst he was deployed back in the 1970s. The group Big Flame, who discovered that they found his birth certificate, and then they found the death certificate of the same name. They confronted him with it. He gave them a cock and bull story. They were so scared. I mean, he ended up disappearing. They were so scared about what they discovered. They never told anybody apart from each other. They wrote up two reports on it, which they sealed and gave to various people, and was like, do not release these unless something happens to a member of Big Flame. He, in the 1980s, approached an Observer journalist about this topic. We know he did that because there's undercover police files, because he was being monitored even then, years later, after he was no longer involved in activism. He was being monitored to see if he would try and contact a journalist about this topic. He spent many years unable to get work, work which he was eminently qualified for. For a very long period of time, you know, blacklisting sentiment truly did destroy numerous lives. You know, perfectly qualified people just unable to get work, losing homes, marriages, you're falling apart. You know, the full thing of it. And often, you know, sometimes these were people who were politically active, who were unable to find work. In other cases, these were people who were just simply, you know, health and safety conscious about the work that they were professionals at. And demanded, you know, the proper standards being put in place, and they were missing out on work because of that.
Didn't, well, who's that guy who was on the like from the royal family? What's his name? Again?
Ricky Tomlinson. Ricky Tomlinson. Yeah.
Didn't he have a problem? Like, wasn't he jailed or something?
Yeah, he was jailed. So he was one of the Shrewsbury 24. The Shrewsbury pickets. Where, you know, there was them doing secondary picketing, I think was the core thing of it. They ended up being locked up over that. Very recently, that's, you know, that case has been proven to be, you know, to be unlawful. And that there's a report that was recently published by a member of the undercover research group about it, which is well worth taking a look at. Again, I'm not something I'm an expert at.
That's cool. Like, will you do me a favor when this is we're done? Will you send me all these links that we've been talking about? Because I want to include them in the description, share them on social media, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I would say you can find links to pretty much everything at spycops.info.
Spycops.info.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
That's great, man. So, in terms of like the people themselves, how are they doing now? Like that have been targeted through spy cops, like. Are they okay? Are they getting the support of friends, family? Like, what's happening? Because I'm really like concerned. Mm. You know, like what?
Yeah, sure.
What does that do to somebody? And are they okay? You know?
Yeah, no. I mean, like very much, very mixed picture. I would say.
Right.
I mean, I think like kind of the Police Spies Out of Lives, which was the group set up by the 8 women who brought that first case, and now includes all the women who were deceived in sexual relationships by undercover officers, has been a fantastic support network for people who have been affected. But I mean, like the problem is that like there's a lot of people who maybe they didn't have a sexual relationship with an undercover officer, but maybe they didn't even feel like they were that close. They weren't a major target, but the impact on them has been like nothing short of significant. There's no two ways about it. I know a great number of people who were politically active when Marco was in our group, who now find it very difficult to even talk about politics. The paranoia levels about it, their personal, like kind of the way in which they were affected by the experience, like still haunts them. I think that's a replicated situation across the country. I think there's a lot of people from a lot of different deployments who were scared off politics. And certainly it was a feeling that I had initially of like kind of you start off and it's like, well, they sent somebody this like, it's like Marco Jacobs. He was like kind of, you know, he was this kind of funny guy, you know, he was like a affable twat, I guess, was that kind of character. And like, you know, you think to yourself, well, like if the first undercover they send into your life is this affable twat, like if you like make a fuss about that, who's the second guy they send in? What are they going to be like? You know, it's going to be something different, right? Yeah. You know? So there's a lot of like kind of, it's a well-founded fear, I think. I mean, I don't necessarily think that, you know, it's like, you know, the same thing exactly going to happen again to the same people. I don't think that like it's a realistic fear on that level, but like it is a perfectly realistic like response and sensible, understandable response, right?
Absolutely, so,
like,
understandable, situation. Man. Yeah,
I think especially in some groups, which may be a bit larger as well, because I think what I was shocked to learn is that I think I just assumed there would be like one officer per group, but actually sometimes there was more than one sent to infiltrate the same group.
Yeah, I mean, like in some cases, you had a situation where, you know, like some groups were majority undercover officers. I mean, I certainly spent certain, even like, I think of one evening where basically, you know, it was me and two undercover cops doing something. Like, you know, I mean, it was, you know, you kind of get situations where, I mean, particularly we see it a lot in like the organized left, which I've never been a part of, but where there's elected positions, you know, for grabs, who've like had, you know, so many positions. I mean, Rick Gibson, who I mentioned earlier in the 1970s, he ended up as the national coordinator of the Troops Out movement. So like essentially the de facto leader of the Troops Out movement as an undercover cop. I mean, like, he's not just in an organization. He's not just like in a senior position in the organization. He's like the public. He's the head of the organization, right? You know, the level to which the depth of the deployments, you know, is it's incredibly significant. And then, of course, I mean, the other thing is that begets. So, like, you've got one undercover officer in an organization like that, and it's like, well, when he's about to be withdrawn, they're like, well, we want somebody else to be in like that kind of position. So, obviously, they have to deploy someone else earlier on who kind of gets like kind of supported through that process by the already deployed undercover officers, and then when they disappear, they're there to, you know, carry on that sort of baton passing, I guess, you know. So you end up within organizations this sort of like culture of undercover policing inside that organization. We particularly see that with the Socialist Worker Party, who it would appear are the most infiltrated group, because the ease of which to get like an elected position on a local level. And then, you know, being able to parlay up to that to the Central Committee, you know.
This doesn't surprise us. We've often had our suspicions about certain members of the SWP. Yes, yeah, it up, Alice, because we know we are.
Whether they are or not, I still hate them.
Right, yeah. I mean, it's been quite interesting, actually, for me as, like, you know, as an anarchist who's been, you know, very critical of the likes of the SWP and pretty much all the organised left over the years in one way or another. Doing this process now of, like, following the inquiry and, like, kind of obviously, you know, many of the people who I'm working alongside are from those kind of groups. And I think, like, all these groups are full of good people. You're not going to join those kind of organizations unless you kind of mean well, at least the beginning, you know.
But when I think that's the... when I say I hate them, I have to be clear that I hate their structures. I know lots of really good activists within it. And actually, probably the individuals I do hate are probably all cops anyway, from what I'm hearing.
Well, I mean, like, so there's this thing... There's a great danger that we do this thing of like kind of anybody I don't like is a cop, right? Which I don't think is helpful. But also I think it's worth remembering that like there's something about the culture that like undercover police are able to insert into situations which they're in, which I think shouldn't be underestimated. One of the things that my personal experience of being infiltrated was one of going from like quite strong militancy to heavy cynicism. Not necessarily my sort of... my rhetoric or anything, but just in my sort of personal response to how we're dealt with things. And I think that like it's likely that any activist environment that has been like saturated with undercover police is going to have its culture like severely warped by that experience. And it means that many people who are not undercover cops or not informers or any way are going to be behaving in ways that is like useful to undercover cops. Do you know what I mean?
It makes you wonder though, thinking that how much of a better world we could be living in if all of our social movements had not been infiltrated and then they'd been set back by years, you know, from infiltration, from activists just ending up burned out because, you know, they've unknown to them, been kind of fighting against this. You know, they've been hindered, but yet they've still had really great success despite the infiltration, you know, but however, it's just been delayed.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think, like, certainly you look at things, particularly like the anti-apartheid movement, you know, like, would Britain have remained such staunch allies of the apartheid South Africa for so long if the anti-apartheid movement had been able to fulfill its aims in without having undercover police, infiltrating at every turn, you know? Certainly, when we look at the popularity of that position, you know, it was, you know, this incredibly, you know, amongst the population, and perfectly, you know, known. Lots of people are against. I mean, like, there's a great revisionism about this, right? Like, everybody was against apartheid now. They bloody weren't. There was plenty of the establishment that were very much for apartheid, and certainly the police were very much for apartheid. But, like, within the population of Britain, there was a lot of support for that, that the anti-apartheid movement, you know, had great difficulty in, like, kind of getting out there because of the infiltration. And not just, like, kind of, like you say, that sort of that psychological warfare that you've been, like, subjected to without really understanding or knowing that that's what's happening to you. That is, yeah, is incredibly burning out. But, like, also, like, people like Rick Gibson getting those positions of power within organizations, ones which could have gone to somebody who was actually committed, who was actually going to do a good job doing it. I mean, a lot of these undercover cops, when it's put to them, oh, you ended up as the treasurer, you end up as this job, as that job, as their defense, they'd go, well, I didn't do anything. I didn't do any actual work at it. I mean, I got the position because I was elected. I didn't do any actual work. I wasn't an entrepreneur provocateur. And it's like, you just told on yourself again. You've got yourself this position of power and then you've not done the work. Like, if somebody else had that position, maybe they'd have done a proper job. Maybe, you know, maybe things would be more, worked better, been more efficient, you know, gone better, you know.
Yeah. That's the thing. What have these deployments achieved? What have they stopped? What have they protected the general public from?
Well, so, I mean, I think, like, there's a number of things, you know. I mean, like, so the infiltration of the Women's Liberation Front in the early 70s, I mean, when they infiltrated them, women weren't allowed to open a bank account. I mean, certainly, like, you know, rape within marriage was only made illegal in 1990. And perhaps if the police hadn't infiltrated the Women's Liberation Front, that might have happened a bit earlier. So, I mean, it's definitely protected married rapists for a while. You see, like, there's the rise of the National Front, like the rise of British fascism. You know, it's because they're not infiltrated, but the anti-fascists are so significantly. There's an argument that maybe, like, the far right is on a life support system that's provided to them by the British state. So that lasts longer. So maybe there's a lot of British fascists who've been, you know, protected by the use of undercover officers. You see, you know, across the board, like, there's lots of, like, progressive causes, which I think were delayed in their success. I think history has proven nearly all these movements right in some way. I mean, I think there's some of them that are yet to be proven right, but I think they will be eventually. But, like, yeah, there's definitely, like, kind of, once you kind of concede that, like, actually the goals of the police, and by definition the goals of the British establishment, is to hold back social progress, then I'm sure they've done a fairly decent job at that, right? They've done a fairly decent job at, like, maintaining a far right in Britain, holding down the far left, you know. I mean, that's kind of, that was the job, and they've probably done a fairly decent job of that, really.
I mean, like, just to your point of what you were saying just earlier, Tom, listening to what you're saying, it's important and we need to hear it, but I could feel myself just going, fucking cunt, do you know what I mean? And that's, like, it really does de-energize you hearing it. Sure. And I think that's something that we need to be aware of. We need to hear this and we need to actually, like, not let up about this and keep making noise about it, because they'll just do the same thing again if people are looking the other way. And I mean, regardless of the outcome of this inquiry or whatever, the more we can disseminate this information, you would hope that people would get onto it and start rethinking their worldview a little bit, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, like, we should never forget, they come at us because we're strong. They come at us because we're doing things that are effective. They come at us because the movements we're part of are, like, having an effect, that we are, you know, like, bringing, you know, those issues to the forefront. We're, you know, effectively doing something. That's why groups are getting infiltrated. And as much as, like, kind of, yeah, it does. I mean, like, it is really hard not to be a bit depressed about it, about, like, kind of, you know, you try and, like, kind of, you try and make the world a better place, and what do you get for your troubles? You get a fucking cop in your life, you know what I mean? But at the end of the day, like, despite that, we still managed to achieve loads of things. I mean, the movements that they infiltrated were still successful. In lots of them were really successful, you know, and that, like, I think it's just like being... So one of the things I really kind of felt, like, when I was really active, there was a cultural problem of not taking it seriously enough. I mean, I come from a very sort of adventurist anarchist tradition, you know, where like a lot of like summit hopping type stuff, you know, and it's kind of like got a lot of like kind of adventure kind of sort of like kind of vibe to it, to be perfectly honest. And like, a lot of that was kind of like kind of went hand in hand with like kind of like, well, you know, it's all a bit of a, you know, but like we have to take these things seriously because there are serious outcomes, there are serious, you know, serious problems going to come in our way because of it. And I think like we definitely, it's a real difficult fight, like fine line to walk as anti-spy cops activists and not turn everybody paranoid. And that's really, that's definitely something I do not want to do. You know, and I would always like urge people to err on the size of no caution. Like, you know, like kind of throw, like you should still do these things, but you need to be a bit more, take it a bit more seriously. And I think like, you know, like a lot of the ways in which the undercover police were really able to like fuck with people was like the way they infiltrated lives rather than movements. So I don't think the problem was necessarily with our movements, but maybe with how we as people were like lived and were able, they were able to exploit us in those ways. You know, I mean, it's a really difficult thing to like quantify. And, you know, I'm not about to like say that people, you know, shouldn't meet prospective partners in political movements, because obviously you're liable to meet people who like kind of really share your worldview when you're involved in political movements. But there are things to be concerned about with that, you know.
Yeah, for sure. There was something that I wanted to pick up. I was told, and it was a few years ago now, but it was somebody rang me up and said, we think you are being infiltrated. And what they said was that it's less about male undercover operatives and it's more about female ones now. Because like people are looking for men, but they weren't necessarily looking for females. Like, to that point, like, can you speak on that? And is there anything else that you know about it?
I mean, that's not something that, like, I'm particularly aware of. One of the things that I've really found from, like, kind of looking at this process is that I'm much less willing to speculate on things. There's things that we know. There's things that we actually know now. Things that we used to have ideas about, but now we actually know, and we know, like, dates and names and places and all that kind of stuff. And that's one of the sort of like, the most useful things that's come out of this inquiry, is that we're able to, like, kind of really pin down genuine facts. Post-2011, it's, like, it's really... I mean, like, I've heard people say that thing before about female undercover operatives. I've heard a lot about electronic surveillance. I've heard a great deal about informers. Apart from the fact that the informer network is enormous, that the electronic surveillance is largely human-based, like it's people at screens using electronic devices to monitor people. It's not algorithms. And it's a very large workforce. So that those areas are huge and they are have significant influence. Beyond that, I wouldn't really like to speculate. I'm sure there are still field officers. I don't know how many of them are going to be... what we know as undercover cops with a completely false persona, and how many of them are going to be actually real people who are professional. So, I mean, like, you know, we live in neoliberal policing is the reality now, right? So a lot of things get subbed out to private contractors. And I wonder how much of the, like, what we used to think of as informers of, like, kind of, I don't know, you know, like somebody with like some problems who like the police are able to exploit, right? Like kind of, you know, the cop, I mean, like I've had some experience with informers in the groups we've been in, and they've been people with like heroin addiction, and the cops have gone, look, you know, we're going to bust you for having heroin on you anytime we see you in public. But if you tell us a little bit of information about that group you're part of, we're not going to bust you. You can go shopping, you can walk around town without getting busted, right? So like those kind of like kind of, well, I wonder how much of it's that anymore, and much more professional informers who are acting as, rather than just like reporting little bits of information back, acting as genuine agents, you know.
Understood. There was Alice, do you remember this, when I got busted on top of that Esso garage roof? And that was it, the early, it was the late 90s.
Yeah.
It was a while ago.
It was early 2000s. That was
it. Okay. So it was then anyway. Yeah, that's right. It was in like gale force winds. I drank a bottle of vodka the night before and I was still half cut. Nobody else would do it, so I jumped up pissed with the banner. But anyway, like, I got busted, and there was two plain clothes, and they were blatantly Special Branch, you know, like with the very fresh off the peg Berghaus fleece and the shiny shoes, you know, the type. Yeah. And they came in towards the end, and it was all like... They did the whole soft soap thing, and then they just came out with it and said, we'll give you money if you inform. And obviously I told them to fuck off and went, unless you're going to charge me with something, I'm getting up and I'm going to leave. So, and then I got up and I left. So I'd already been processed and all of that, got off of the caution, whatever. But I think
we'd filled the police station as well.
Oh, yeah, all them were at the police station stickering the chief superintendent's face and stuff when I got out. By the time I got out, I think they just wanted rid of them.
Yeah.
Like I always recommend everybody do that. If your mate gets nicked, everybody turn up the station, man. Culturally, we always used to do that, didn't we? I mean, everybody always do that. Really, please do. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, like this, after that happened to me, it all the way back then, it got me thinking and it got me obviously thinking about this. So when this came along, I was shocked, but I wasn't surprised, if that makes sense. When, you know, what you're saying there, the evidence was in and it was clear that this had actually been happening. Yeah. Because it was around about that time that, like, obviously we mentioned before, we had doubts about certain people, which we'll never be able to prove. But what we do know is they arrived from nowhere, caused loads of hassle between people and then fucked off as soon as that arrived. Mm. And that group was no more, or it was splintered into other things. And it just feels like there was a hell of a lot of manipulation going on.
That's such a familiar story. I mean, both of those stories, the one of like people I've heard so many people, you know, have been nicked for fairly minor stuff, getting special branch kind of coming up to them at the end of after they've been processed, going, well, you know, there could be a few quid in this for you if you really, you know, didn't want to get in trouble again. We know you mean well, you're only trying to do it for the right reasons, but there are people in your group who are a little bit more dangerous than that, aren't there? And, you know, perhaps you could be helping us keep the community safe. And then also,
lads, we're anarchists. We're not massive fan of money. So, like, how about fuck off?
Right, fucking right, man. But then, like, the thing that thing of like kind of groups falling apart because of the influence of undercover officers. I mean, that's definitely one of the things they keep claiming in the inquiry is that they were there, deployed to look at subversion and public disorder. But the reality is, it seems very clear that they were there also to do disruption within the groups. There's plenty of things in the tradescraft manual that hint at that. You know.
Yeah. I mean, we were literally non-violent direct action at the time. Like, I fail to see, like, what the infiltration, like, you know, I'm thinking from the perspective of the average Joe in the street, they would be like, well, they were peaceful, you know? Like, what's...
Yeah, that's no defense, man. Just because it's peaceful, I mean, the fact that it was peaceful just means that you just get these cops rather than the more serious ones, right? I mean, like, that's what they specialize in. Like, you know, nonviolent direct action, I think, as a concept, is incredibly dangerous to the establishment because, like, if it took off culturally, right, and everybody's like, oh yeah, well, we can always do that, you know, then like, it's like that could be a real problem, right? So like, they want to squash that. They really want to squash that. They want to squash those kind of. Those attitudes, so that even considering that kind of thing as an option, and I think there's also a feeling that like kind of the more that you can suppress those things happening, the less likely it's to spread. You know, like, because if people don't see it, if there's less of it, then there's less likely to be new movements that are doing it. You know,
yeah. I mean, I'd really love to know like how many of these sort of like groups that like sprang up were just disbanded as a result of this. It's absolute fuckery. I mean, also, I mean, we talked a lot about like sort of activists and grassroots people like ourselves who've been like affected or think they've been affected, like in our case. But I read that there was a couple of MPs who were infiltrated as well.
Yeah. I mean, like, essentially, like anybody who kind of got sort of like within that remit, you know. So I mean, like, so Peter Hain was the first MP, like politician who's given evidence to the inquiry. His involvement in the anti-apartheid movement in the 70s kind of first got him kind of being spied on. But like, I mean, what's really telling is in 2003, when he's a senior member of the cabinet, he's Welsh secretary, he's father of the House of Commons, he's just voted for the fucking Iraq war. He's described by an undercover officer who comes into contact with him at a social gathering as a South African terrorist. I mean, it really sort of illustrates how, like, kind of in this country, like, as much as the government are in charge to a certain extent, this country belongs to the establishment, right? And like, even if you're a Labour MP, he went on to be a Lord, like, I mean, he's a Lord now. I mean, even a Labour MP at the heart of government, you're still fair game, right, to these people. So every single political party in the UK has been infiltrated by undercover cops, except for the Conservative Party.
who are allegedly directing said cops.
Well, I mean, it's their state, right? I mean, they might not always be in government, but it's always their state.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah, yeah, absolutely right, man.
Yeah.
Do you think, like, let's say a Keir Starmer government got in? Not going to happen. You know what I'm going to say next?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think he's going to change things?
Is he, fuck? He's not going to change his fucking underpants, is he? I mean, like, look at the state of the shame of him. Jesus Christ. No, like, no, certainly do not. Like, when people tell you who they are, believe them the first time. I mean, like, really, I don't understand why. Do you know what I mean? Like, we saw his record as director of public prosecutions. You know what I mean? Like, the guy's a fucking... Yeah, Jesus Christ. Yeah, no, nothing is going to change on that front for sure.
Nothing at all is going to change on that front.
He had to be forced to oppose the proposed police and crime sentencing bill. Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, he did. I mean, like, he was fully intending to abstain on it. They abstained on the covert human intelligence sources bill, the so-called spy cops bill, which kind of undermines the whole bloody inquiry, by the way, but that's another matter. But yeah, I mean, I don't think he really didn't want to, did he? I mean, like, he was really forced into to opposing. I mean, you know, it's amazing. I mean, I had no like kind of expectations of Starmer doing a decent job. I think he's a psychopath, just like kind of just the way he sort of behaves. But I mean, even I have been like underwhelmed with his behavior. He's like, wow, you've been really shit. Like, not just a bit shit, but like on every level as well. Like even their, I mean, I don't, this is totally off topic now, but like even their like basic graphic design is shit. I don't get it. Like, how are they so bad? It's weird.
Did you see that? Sorry, Alice, you go ahead and I'll come in with
one. Going on about Keir Starmer, I think I was even surprised, and I didn't have high expectations of him, because he kind of, when he was wanted, you know, trying to be Labour leader, he tried to put himself forward as this, you know, great human rights lawyer who helped out the McLibel trial.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And try and take the credit for that, even though they effectively had to represent themselves for all of that time. And he gave a little bit of advice around that. And those people were affected by spy cops. You would have thought he might have had something about him, but no.
Nice.
Sorry, one of my dogs appears to have hidden one of his bones under a bloody cushion over there. And I was like, what's he rustling about for? So I've forgotten what I was going to say. I was just like, shut up, dude.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that whole thing of like Keir Starmer's involvement in the McLibel thing, you know, it's like, I think, you know, it's a common, I mean, I know a lot of lawyers now, and I mean, a lot of them are really like, they're passionate people who are working on human rights, and they could have had much more successful careers by doing something else. But also, I think it's very clear that like within, like, as a lawyer, it's like human rights stuff's interesting, right? So, like, yeah, like loads of people who've gone on to be complete bastards did some human rights work when early on in their career, because it's like interesting stuff. As if you're like a law geek, which lawyers tend to be, then you kind of, a bit of human rights, voluntary work and human rights stuff when you're starting off, that looks good on the CV. It's kind of interesting. Yeah, you've done a bit of it. You know, like the way that he's like a human rights lawyer, I'm just like,
yeah, that's a label and half. Tom, we've had you for long enough, mate, but I just wanted to say one thing, just on a human level. Like, you and people like you doing this kind of stuff are our heroes. Like, we look to you and we look up to you for what you're doing. And I don't know if you get told that enough, but just thank you. It's not about, like, sort of people banging it in the back of the net for the football club. For me, I've fucking fucked off football a long time ago because of the money. You are my Alan Shearer, and for a Geordie, that's high praise indeed.
Don't look up to people, man. We'll only disappoint you. Like, Jesus.
But, yeah, thank you. I mean, no, like, gods, you know, no masters and all that, apart from Tom Fowler.
Like, no, t-shirt coming on,
like, thank you so much for everything you're doing, and regardless of the outcomes, it's sometimes it's about like what you do on the way, like you know, I understand that maybe you won't get held to account, but as long as more people get to hear about this and the penny drops with some, and hopefully that has a ripple effect, and as we move forward as a people, there'll be more and more people switched on, because I am like you, I'm hopeful. Like, the younger generation coming through take no shit, and they're very savvy generally, and they're very switched on in general. So I'm bloody hopeful about what could come as we move forward, you know?
I mean, I think that's the key thing. Like, kind of I don't think there's any, like, there's going to be no resolution to this undercover policing thing, right? There is no end stage to it. Like, this inquiry is just a vehicle for us to use as, like, a way of campaigning around it. It's not something that we're tied to as a thing. When the inquiry ends, there will be some other way we will use to, like, draw attention to this topic. It's kind of, I've ended up as, like, an intel. I never meant this to be my specialist subject, like, but it ended up being because of my life experience. But I think, like, the actual real kind of opportunity for justice and a better society comes as it always has. It comes from below, and it comes from the next generation of people just not, like you say, not taking the shit, man, not taking the shit. And, like, you know, these things kind of come in waves, but we can only hope that we get a big enough wave one day that we'll drown all those bastards.
Yeah, for real, man. Tom Fowler, a scholar, a gentleman, our God. What an outro. No, seriously, mate, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate you giving us your time, but also everything that you do. So,
cheers, man. Cheers for having me on. I started doing my own podcast recently, Spy Cops Info podcast, which I'm very new to. So that, like, the audio of it is started off terrible. I think it's getting a bit better now. But
I've been listening to it. It's great.
Cheers. Yeah. So
links will be in the description of podcast for your podcast. It's we're so meta.
Yeah.
But thanks so much, mate, and it's an open invitation as things develop. If you need to, like, hop back on, we're going to start live streams as well, so if you want to get involved in that later on as we grow this, then happy days, man.
Cool, I'd love to.
Season 2 of Milk the Cow podcast, this time with visuals and live streams. Word man, thanks again, and you as well, Alice, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers, man.
Cheers, both.